Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings here on the 15th of November, where we're broadcasting live from the studios of KTAS Faith Radio, just north and east of Minneapolis-St. Paul, Minnesota. Love joining you each morning here on Faith Radio Mornings as we talk about the news and the headlines of the day from a distinctly Christian perspective. If you listen regularly, you know that I often say that we together fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, because it is the only kingdom that he is the king of that knows no end. All the other kingdoms of this world will fade and they will fail. And so we walk out life with our eyes fixed upwards and not always on the things of this world. Love being part of this with you. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and joined in studio by Rachel Sutton and Paul Perot, who do the great job bringing guests from around our country to speak to these topics from a Christian standpoint. And as always, we do love to hear from you as well throughout the course of our 2 hours together. So if there's anything a guest says or any kind of comment or question you'd like to make, you can please call us or text us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Well, it is Thursday morning, and that means that one of our favorites here, Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, you can see his work at acton.org. He's been in journalism for a number of years. He's been in radio. He has been in pastoral ministry, and he comes on every Thursday morning here on Faith Radio Mornings to talk about the news headlines of the day. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Peter.
So lots to get to here in just a little bit. We see that there's the Florida recount happening where the ballots are due and the counts are due by about 3 o'clock this afternoon. We see the possibility of the United Kingdom crashing out of the European Union next March in the absence of some kind of Brexit deal. But the headline, Ben, that really caught my attention as we prep for Thanksgiving next week, and we often need a lot of room in our refrigerators, is that today is National Clean Out Your Refrigerator Day. Time to throw out that moldy cheese and box of weeks-old leftovers, because it is the day in which we do that with our refrigerators. You can give your fridge a nice scrub and prep for Thanksgiving. Ben, do you have any thoughts on what was the worst sort of food science experiment that you found in your refrigerators over the years?
I would have to say that, occasionally it devolved to the point where I was afraid I would need a hazmat outfit in order to clean things out. That was probably the worst. Various things that you had to clean. The worst thing ever actually was an abandoned refrigerator that we had unplugged, and something had gotten left behind. So that was the worst.
I think sometimes when I see old taco meat in the back of the refrigerator, that something like that could actually spontaneously spring to life. I don't know why I handle it with such care, but you see this growing thing. It's amazing how life can grow in the midst of cold and death like that.
It is. So more hope for life after death, I guess. The fact that even our food continues to live in our refrigerators. Yeah.
It's Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute. We're going to take a short break and get into some of the news headlines of the day. And, of course, if you want to chat with Ben or with me or just be part of the program in any way, please do call us or text us this morning at 877-933-2484. Welcome this morning to Faith Radio Mornings for the 15th of November.
Is my right, a right given by God to live a free life, to live in freedom.
It's about 9 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and you've already heard the voice of Ben Johnson, our weekly contributor to the program on Thursday mornings. Sure love talking through all the different news elements with him, the headlines, what's out there. And Ben, today it seems like it's going to be circling around what's happening in Florida, see if we finally get any kind of finalization of what's going on in the Senate race, the gubernatorial race. Did you find some ballots under your bed this morning as well that you got to get there by 3 o'clock this afternoon?
Well, they seem to be popping up everywhere else, so why not?
Yeah. So where are we at with this process at this point? Was it a machine malfunction? Do we wonder if there's any kind of corruption going on? Just kind of remind our listeners about what's happening in Florida relative to the race down there for Senate.
Well, the fact that you have an election doesn't mean that it ever ends, apparently, in Florida. The election ended on Tuesday, but the votes are still being counted. There were some very serious questions about electoral fraud happening, particularly in Broward County. At a minimum, there is certainly some malfeasance, whether it's deliberate or unintentional. But the race for governor was very close. Gillum had conceded the race and then revoked his concession a few days ago in order to allow this recount to go forward. Senator Nelson has allowed the vote to continue against Rick Scott, who is the current governor running for Senate. He had a 56,000 vote lead on Election Day. That's been whittled down to about 12,005 due to various measures that have come under fire. One of them, as I say, particularly the figure who's been the pivot of all this is Brenda Snipes, who's the top election official in Broward County. They have tens of thousands of ballots that have been discovered after Election Day. 80,000 ballots are sort of under a question mark. And she has a very troubled history, to say the least. But even this election, she didn't report all of the votes on Election Day within 30 minutes of the polls closing, which is what's required by law. She posted election results before the polls were closed, according to one account. She didn't allow candidates to see the vote count as it was going on, so they were unsupervised. And she took 205 rejected provisional ballots, which had been opened and looked at and had been cast out, and mixed them in with bona fide votes. And so it's not clear if votes that have been rejected have now been counted in favor of one candidate or another, even in that one instance. There are widespread allegations of voter fraud. This could be yet another recount. Even after this, some of the machines themselves have melted down trying to count these ballots. Once the machines finish, any election that's within 0.25% will go to a hand recount, and that recount by law has to end on Sunday unless a judge intervenes. So you have a very, very dubious situation going on in Florida. And not just Florida, of course. In Georgia, we've had at least three Democratic officials, Hillary Clinton, Cory Booker, and Sherrod Brown, have all said the governor's race has been stolen from Stacey Abrams, even though it looks as though Brian Kemp still has more than a 50% lead right now. But three Obama-appointed judges have kept that recount going, and it looks as though it could potentially turn into a runoff election on December 4th. So at least two states, two governor's races, U.S. Senate race, all under a cloud because we have not taken care of our electoral laws.
Well, it's been pretty interesting, too, to hear some of the comments coming out. I noted that their former Secretary of State, Katherine Harris, who oversaw the races between presidential candidates Bush and Gore in the controversy in 2000 in Florida, she seemed to suggest that this kind of thing where we have difficulty counting the ballots happens more often than we think.
We have close elections. I said earlier it's not a constitutional crisis. It's a close race. We're going to have these close races. You're not going to have that in New York or California. You're going to have election problems in every state. You just don't hear about it because it's not going to turn an election.
You know, Ben, it sounds like she was maybe trying to dial down the rhetoric, but what I heard in that is that maybe we need to look at a little bit more widespread reform to the voting system.
It certainly seems that way. The fact of the matter is this happened 18 years ago with the presidential election coming down to a few hundred votes, and you're seeing the same state, the same problems. In fact, in some cases from previous elections, the same officials, in the case of Brenda Snipes, all within questions of the law, whether they're following the law either through malfeasance or through deliberate malign intention. But all of these things have to be reformed if we value our democracy. If we believe that our vote counts, then an invalid vote is like a counterfeit bill. It devalues the value of the genuine article. So counterfeit votes can't be allowed to be counted. Fraudulent votes cannot be allowed to be counted. And there has to be some kind of accountability to say, at the very least, that all votes have to be in custody of someone. They have to be viewed by members of both parties or nonpartisan officials at all times, and that they should be counted promptly, efficiently, And we should have votes and elections that last less than the term of office of the person who's going to be elected.
Talking with Ben Johnson this morning from the Acton Institute, Ben, shifting our attention to some global headlines, we see that apparently there is some sort of at least temporary deal struck between Prime Minister Theresa May of the United Kingdom and the rest of the European Union as they're trying to figure out what exiting the European looks like in that situation next March. But the implications for that from a global standpoint, even from us, is that what happens here might set precedent for further further countries leaving the European Union in the future. And what do we see for the future of the EU in this?
Well, right now what we see is that the EU drives a hard bargain, and generally they win when they negotiate. Theresa May has come home with an agreement, and it looks as though it's not going to hold up. I was just watching as we went to air. She may still be being questioned in front of the House of Commons, and I really feel for her. You can, if you have a sense of empathy, you can see the strain that she's under this intense questioning. She brought back a deal that was incredibly negative on every single front. It guarantees $50 billion or 39 billion British pounds to the EU as a divorce bill. It says that the UK has to adopt every law or regulation passed by the EU for the next 2 years as it remains in the custom union with no vote or say in passing those laws. And then there's what's called a backstop for Northern Ireland, which is that the Irish don't want a customs checkpoint to develop across the border between Northern and Southern Ireland. That's been a sore point for a very long time, going back to the Troubles. So if the UK doesn't negotiate a free trade agreement with the EU, then Northern Ireland would accept all EU rules in perpetuity, no matter what. That was the condition the EU asked for, even if the rest of the UK doesn't accept those rules. And the backstop to the backstop would be, if that doesn't work, the whole UK will follow EU rules in perpetuity. One of the points that opponents keep raising is there's no provision for the UK to leave this backstop on its own. And this entire deal violates Theresa May's campaign promises from last year when she called the snap election, which turned out disastrously for her. This morning alone, she's had four resignations from her cabinet, three significant cabinet ministers, including her own Brexit secretary, Dominic Raab. The EU, as you might imagine, has been quick to try and certify this. They're going to meet on Sunday, November 25th, and vote this through, and approve it. But Theresa May needs 320 votes out of 650. The Labour Party is opposed to it. The DUP, on which her entire government depends for its majority, is opposed to it. The Scottish National Party is opposed, and at least 84 Conservative members of her own party are opposed to it. So it's not clear how she's ever going to get this through. She's negotiated it, and frankly, it's a disaster.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to watch in the next couple of months to see how this goes in terms of whether they crash out in a hard Brexit or finally come to some sort of negotiated truce. That's Ben Johnson. Ben, we'll take a break here, and when we come back, change the conversation over to the new developments within Amazon. They've chosen their headquarters. They split it between two places as they continue to grow the business, and we see some pushback from people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and I would love to get your take on what she had to say about providing tax breaks and incentives to a $1 trillion company. So more with Ben Johnson and next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're talking through the headlines of the day with Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, and we highly recommend going to acton.org to see the work that Ben and others do. It's a really good, in-depth journalism, trusted, reliable, unlike the maybe every two-hour cycle that we head into now, where we just don't even know what's happening with the headlines and the facts and whether they're actually true across the board. Ben does a great job bringing some perspective and wisdom to so much of what interests us today. And Ben, I saw that Amazon has finally chosen, after a long courting process through many cities, to plant their headquarters actually not just in one location but in two. We see Arlington, Virginia, and we see Queens, New York. And the new incoming Congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's a Democratic Socialist, talked a bit about the fact that we should not be providing tax incentives and tax breaks for a $1 trillion company. What was your take on that, Ben?
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez here is part right and part wrong. I was happy to find that I was partially in agreement with what she had to say. You know, Amazon had 238 different cities across North America competing for them, and part of the competition process was that they would offer either tax incentives and tax breaks, or in some cases outright grants. And it's that latter one that really concerns me, which is that, you know, for example, New York agreed to $1.525 billion between the two. But I think Arlington allowed more than $500 million in grants to the company. So that's taxpayer money going to a private organization so that it would create jobs here. Now, the total amount is about $2.2 billion or a little bit more than $2.2 billion. Amazon has announced that it's going to – and some of this is contingent upon the creation of jobs. Amazon has said that between those two cities and a 5,000-person group in Nashville, where it's got another center that is going to open, it will be a total of 55,000 jobs. Each one of them will pay $100,000. So you're looking at more than $5 billion worth of investment in exchange for $2.2 billion in tax credits and grants. That's all well and good, but first of all, this is not the role of government to hand money to private corporations. That's completely and utterly inappropriate. Second of all, obviously this favors certain organizations, particularly well-connected organizations, well-connected corporations who have political friends. And so it's the government picking winners and losers with your money. And that particularly should be of concern to anyone who's interested in having a level playing field. That I don't have any problem with tax incentives, that is, lower taxes. The fact of the matter is some states that offered heavy incentives could have slashed their corporate tax 70% across the board for the amount of money they were willing to give to one company. So if they would simply give that to everyone, you would see an incredible flourishing, more jobs even than Amazon is allowing. And secondly, this is how you get the next Amazon, is because they start out as a potential competitor and they flourish because they have something that's new, something that is cutting edge. And this is how the American dream continues, how technological progress happens. They have to have the ability to compete on a fair and equal playing ground. So I think from a moral point of view, the idea of picking winners and losers and the idea of favoritism, cronyism should be of concern to everyone. She's right about that.
Well, I think it's absolutely fascinating to watch, because it wasn't more than maybe 10, 15 years ago that you could go to Amazon to buy some used books, and to watch their sort of methodical march taking over our economy in so many different ways. It's going to be really interesting to see moving forward. Ben, another headline that came out was that Harvard hosted a conference on Marxism here recently. And I know how much you favor and support Marxism, so I assume you were in attendance there. Couldn't wait to hear what they had to say, right?
I appreciate the way you sully my reputation with your listeners. Just to be clear, I'm not, in fact, a Marxist, somewhat anti-Marxist, to say the least. but I don't know why they need a conference. Frankly, if you just go to class, you probably pick up most of what you need to know about Marxism from your professors. But, yeah, the Harvard International Socialists held an agreement. It's a first-time conference on capitalism and climate change, and they have things like intersectionality and oppression, issues of this sort, which shows not only economic socialism, but also a focus on cultural issues, identity politics, and the way that the hard left is using those issues to polarize things. But I think that that sort of a conference, and the fact that there is any interest in attending that kind of a conference, talks about how very much the Christians have to engage in the public square and to make clear that socialism is opposed to the gospel in every conceivable way. If you believe in private property, you believe it cannot be expropriated. Thou shalt not steal applies even if you have the government on your side, taking privately earned money from people and giving it to those who did not earn it for reasons other than an absolute necessity. So where it comes to the legitimate functions of government, that is permissible. But when it comes to the government stepping outside of its prescribed roles, and particularly something that is harmful to people, such as welfare dependence and things of that sort, that is bad for society in general, harms our overall technological progress, harms our ability to provide for ourselves, and harms charity, particularly Christian charities, which are assumed, their roles are simply subsumed by the state. The state comes in as the charity and the great overseer of all people. From cradle to the grave, there's really no space in that for Christians to exercise their ministries of mercy, their ministries of love and compassion, caring for the corporeal needs of those around us. So Christians have to speak out against this kind of a thing. And first of all, to speak out, they have to understand that this is opposed to them, and they will find themselves squeezed out of the public sphere if they allow socialism and its view of society to continue to spread among young people.
Well, Ben, we have just about 30 seconds left, but there does seem to be a momentum. It's almost like some places we've got to test out a different way to find out that, at least in history, we've never seen socialism or Marxism work out well.
Well, it's the history of the judges. They continually would fall into foreign hands, and then they would cry out to God for deliverance, and then they would go right back to their wicked ways. And the United States seems to be following the path of other nations that have gone down this path of envy, and ultimately they sow the wind, they reap the whirlwind.
Well, Sven Johnson from the Acton Institute, Ben, you do such a great job talking us through the headlines. Love your presence here every Thursday morning. Have a great weekend, and have a great holiday week next week as well.
On that positive note, you have a great week, and God bless.
Yeah, you too. We'll take a break here for Lighten Up and Bottom of the Hour News. And when we come back for the second half of this hour, I had a conversation with Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog about the history of Thanksgiving. Of course, on Faith Radio Mornings, we have been following the events in California all week in terms of the raging wildfires and the destruction that is being caused there. We see that now more than 10,000 structures have been burned to the ground as what is known as campfire wreaks havoc in Northern California. Most of those were single-family homes. The death toll is unfortunately now up to 56 people. One of the sheriffs there says that could keep going up as more and more bodies are discovered. In the south near Los Angeles, there is another fire as well that has destroyed about 450 buildings and over 150 square miles. The fires there are considered to be about 50% contained. So continue, as you're listening all throughout the Midwest and all throughout our country, to pray for the people impacted deeply by these fires.
During this season of Thanksgiving, do you praise God for what you have or for what He's done? This is Jim Garlow. Thanksgiving comes in multiple levels. Simple thankfulness for the things you have. Gratefulness even in the face of trials. And then, praise. Praise for what God has actually done. Remember when the children of Israel faced the Red Sea, which God miraculously parted? Beyond ensuring their safe passage, the Lord then inundated Pharaoh and his armies. Miriam led the people in a song in Exodus chapter 15, verse 21, in which she exalts God by detailing the great things He's done. What about you, friend? Think of the little things He's done in your life. More importantly, reflect often on the big thing, sending Jesus to give you His righteousness and bear your sins so you will enter His heaven. This is Jim Garlow.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings, and delighted to be joined in studio by Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog, who's a professor of history, the chair of history here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul, and has joined us pretty regularly here on Faith Radio Mornings to just talk about different dimensions of political history. And now in this case, we're going to talk a little bit about holiday history with Thanksgiving fast approaching. We wanted to have Jonathan in to give us a little sense of the history of Thanksgiving. Good morning, Jonathan.
Well, good morning. Once again, it's excellent to be here and be in studio.
Well, I love having you in studio like this, and I have to admit that beyond, you know, the pilgrims showing up and having some sort of dinner with the original Americans, I really know nothing about the history of Thanksgiving. So if I showed up at that first Thanksgiving Day table, would it be green bean casserole? Would it be sweet potatoes and marshmallows? What would I have experienced back then?
First of all, you may be showing up expected or unexpected. There's actually some suggestion that maybe when the Native Americans came, they just showed up. That there wasn't even a formal invite, but they thought this would be a good chance to get together. So you may have been expected, you may not have been expected. One of the key dishes from the first Thanksgiving was actually eel.
Eel.
So I don't know if you have a real good eel recipe to share, but of course they were right on the Atlantic Ocean, and eel was easy to obtain both on the mud flats around Plymouth and in the rivers. So eel was a prominent piece. They called wild birds the fowl, F-O-W-L.
Yeah.
We don't know that there were turkey. Turkey were usually pretty hard to catch. but there may have been some wild bird on the table as well.
I find that fascinating. I mean, I love my sushi, like the nice guy, you know, in terms of unagi is the eel. Mm-hmm. I would have never imagined that there would ever be a Thanksgiving Day table with sushi on it.
Well, just suggest to the pilgrims to add some rice and some seaweed, wrap it up, and you're all good.
I love it. Okay, so the rough time frame? When did this happen again? Remind our listeners, remind me, and sort of what began to unfold as a result of this gathering?
Right. Well, the key dates that people usually point to, 1620 is the year that the pilgrims came over from England. And, of course, there's a whole backstory as to why they're on the Mayflower by themselves as this one group coming over to America. It actually has to do with their desire for religious liberty and economic opportunity tied together. So there's an interesting story there. 1620, they were going to be on two ships. The other ship sprung a leak, so they're all crammed aboard the Mayflower. Before they even get off, they have to sign the Mayflower Compact, which is an agreement for self-government amongst themselves. And then they get off the boat in late fall of 1620. Now, I love New England, but that's not the most hospitable time, right? It's cold. It's rainy, and they have to start their colony from scratch at the worst possible time of the season. But they do. That first winter is very rough. They call it a suffering time, a sick time. There were times when there were only 7 people who were healthy enough to make sure that everything ran. Other people were sick with the climate, with new world diseases. So it was a very difficult time that first winter. The spring comes. They don't know what's going to happen when they have some encounters with remarkably Native Americans who actually speak English.
Hmm.
And to that point, they're amazed because they didn't even know how they would interact with the natives. It turns out that the first person to make contact was an Indian named Samoset, and Samoset had learned English from various travelers, and so he was able to be a go-between with the nearby tribes. In fact, he walked into the settlement and said, "Welcome, Englishmen," and I think they were just blown away by that. So Samoset is there to help. One of his associates is named Squanto. Squanto also speaks English. Squanto knows how to raise crops and deal with the wildlife, including the eel, in the New World. And so he's helping them. And so then by the fall of 1621, when they bring the harvest in, is often seen as the first Thanksgiving. And, you know, this is debated. It's not as kind of clear as we've built it up over the years, but they were clearly having a harvest festival and giving thanks to God in the fall of 1621.
Was there really a different sort of religious mindset between the two traditions? However, I would assume that the Native Americans had a very different perception of God than maybe the Western European Christians would have had, and yet they shared sort of this gratefulness back and forth. Would that be fair to say?
Well, they're definitely sharing the meal, and they share contests. There were apparently foot races and maybe some shooting displays. So there were athletic contests even on Thanksgiving Day in 1621.
This is brilliant. I mean, this is way better than just sitting and having a meal watching football.
That's
We could actually have like almost like a Highland Games or something on Thanksgiving.
This is the active going out and doing it yourself, not just eating and then falling asleep with the turkey in front of the TV. So they were actively involved, but we know that these separatists, pilgrims who were also Protestants, definitely believed the scriptures. They would have come from an English background where harvest festivals were common, right? This is a good thing to celebrate. But they would have done it not necessarily as a church celebration, but nevertheless as a Christian celebration, giving thanks to God. So I think they really had that mindset that it was God and God who had providentially brought them, protected them, and then given them this harvest.
So did it happen on a Thursday, or did Thursday come later in this deal in terms of when we're celebrating this?
Yeah, we don't exactly know when this happened, except that it was the fall of 1621. There's another Thanksgiving recorded in 1623, but it's not set on a Thursday until the 1860s, actually.
And you're referencing, you said earlier that the pilgrims are coming from a situation in which they were experiencing not the best circumstances related to economic and religious opportunity. So give us a little sense of the background that even provides a bit of the context for the importance of this meal.
Right. So if you take several steps back, remember, in the wake of the Protestant Reformation and Martin Luther that we just celebrated a few weeks ago, England had developed its own Protestant church, the Church of England. But these were Protestants in England, so they agreed with that point, but they thought the church had not reformed enough. It was not as in line with the scriptures as they hoped it would be. And so even though they were still Protestants, they deemed the need to separate from the Church of England to have a more pure, more biblical church. But in England, that itself was illegal. And so these separatists were being persecuted, had been persecuted, had spent time in prison, had faced fines for even being on the Protestant side of the things. So they said, what are we going to do about this? This group had themselves then become immigrants. They had left England to go to the Netherlands. The Netherlands at the time was a place where there was a lot of religious liberty. You could practice your faith fine. And they did, and they appreciated that. But they said, even as we're free to worship, we find that there are many other pieces that we are not appreciating about the Netherlands. We don't have good economic opportunities. Because we're immigrants, we have very few jobs that are open to us. People are getting worn down by manual labor. And we're also a little bit concerned about the culture. We're not sure about how our families are developing. And so for all of these reasons, they said, we believe it's God's leading to go to this new world. Even though it's a wilderness, they thought that was a better option.
That's a fascinating backstory to that, and it speaks to the importance of hospitality. And we'll take a short break, Doctor, and when we come back, we'd love to talk about it. It almost feels like a role reversal in the sense that it was the white Western Europeans that needed to be the recipients of hospitality in an immigration situation. So we'll get into more about the history and what we can expect to look forward to at Thanksgiving coming up here next week on Faith Radio Mornings. Having a fun conversation with Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog about the history of Thanksgiving a little bit as we anticipate celebrating it next week as a country. And I'm just curious, when Thanksgiving hits for you next week, what are you going to look for that has to be on the Thanksgiving Day table? Otherwise, it just simply isn't Thanksgiving.
Ironically for me, I think of the green bean casserole as
a
typical Midwestern, and I understand it's a Minnesota, it's an Iowa tradition. And so I really associate that with Thanksgiving celebration, along with my turkey, my potatoes, and my gravy.
Yeah.
But I'm going to put some green bean casserole there.
See, I never had the green bean casserole growing up. It was all about mashed potatoes and then mixing the corn in with the mashed potatoes. That little blend together, that was Thanksgiving Day. But my wife is English, and it was sweet potatoes with marshmallows on top. I'd never heard of that. That seems like a dessert kind of thing.
I don't know. We definitely have the sweet potatoes as well. So it's multiple textures going on there. We really appreciate it.
But before the break, we were talking a little bit about just almost this role reversal kind of idea that you see these white Western Europeans show up on the shores of a foreign country, and they're greeted by the Native Americans, and there is an incredible form of hospitality being extended at this moment.
Right, and I think that that's really useful to think about, that these pilgrims have very little when they're coming, right? We should think they're traveling in search of a better life. And it is the help of, as we said, Squanto and Samoset that really helped them get established and then to create working relationships with the nearby tribe. It was actually the Wampanoag tribe under Chief Massasoit. And they were able to establish a good living relationships for the next several decades that not perfect, but workable, looking at two cultures living in proximity.
Yeah, it was a fascinating time back then. I mean, they shared this meal together, were working together. But why was this not just then a one-off meal? Did it get celebrated the next year and eventually begin to extend to the point where it's this incredible national holiday?
Right. Well, we know that another celebration was held in 1623, The account there says that they by being able to give each family a plot of their land, they were able to see even more increase. So they saw that as God's blessing. And so this became a Plymouth-centric celebration. But then as other people filtered into especially Boston, Massachusetts, and then the whole New England area, Thanksgiving was a regular annual celebration in the towns. It was a town declaration and then the colonial declarations. And so it became a regional celebration. And then once the new nation was put into place, after the American Revolution, after the Constitution, we see national Thanksgivings being called for by Congress and by President George Washington and by President John Adams. Although, remarkably, it was Thomas Jefferson who said, I don't think the president should be making such declarations. And so he stopped the practice. And so there was no national Thanksgiving from 1801 down to the 1860s.
That is phenomenal. So when, how did it pick back up again? Who was sort of the motivation or impetus behind that?
Well, if you think 1860s, this would be President Abraham Lincoln.
Yep.
So during the Civil War, there were lots of ups and downs, but Lincoln said it is appropriate to nationally be giving thanks for the blessings that God has bestowed. And so actually just in my Civil War class yesterday, we read Lincoln's Thanksgiving Day Proclamation from 1863. And so he started that new tradition of calling for an annual Thanksgiving in November, even, that we still have today.
And was there always a direct association even before it was stopped for a temporary period? And then obviously with Abraham Lincoln as well, was it an association that it was a Thanksgiving Day directed towards gratefulness to God specifically?
It was. And that's something I've really appreciated as I've read various Thanksgiving proclamations, is these are in many cases very Christian, using language of thanks not only for bountiful harvest, but for liberty, civil liberty, and religious liberty, they often highlight, also for the blessings of the gospel. And so Thanksgiving was to be celebrated not just among families in the private realm, but in the churches. The churches were to take the lead in demonstrating and giving thanks as central meeting points for the community.
That's fascinating, because we don't really talk much in church about the Thanksgiving Day kind of – it's really been sort of taken over by the football season more than anything else. That gets to be some of our tradition. So the fact it was so tied into gratefulness specifically to God, what do you see today in terms of the expression of it? Is it as much in terms of thankfulness to God, or are we sort of have this invitation to have a spirit of thankfulness somehow?
That's right. I feel like we're encouraged to – be thankful vaguely,
mm-hmm.
right, to the natural order or to that kind of benevolent deity that may or may not exist, right? Whereas the origins here in the United States are much more explicitly Christian. And so that's the type of practice that I think we can be nurturing, of Thanksgiving directly to God, recognizing that all good gifts come from Him. And to do this in our churches and even in the private realms that we find ourselves with our family and with our friends. And I think it's that gratitude to God that helps us fight back against the commercialization of Thanksgiving. And so one of the things I definitely protest against is all of the stores saying you should shop on Thanksgiving Day. No, you should pause. You should use it as a family time and a time to really give thanks to God. And not think about stuff. Like, let's put our materialism on hold for just one day to recognize where these gifts come from.
Yeah, certainly when I started opening up the Black Friday mailings from the various retail outlets, there almost gets to be a sense in which I start feeling entitled, that I should be able to get this or that or this or that. And gratitude really is the opposite of entitlement, isn't it? And it's just such an important, almost spiritual discipline that we have an invitation into.
I think that's right, that we need that. Recognizing that this isn't just our doing, right? It's not about us ultimately. And so everything is a gift. The world is a gift. The families we find ourselves are in is a gift. And even our larger national setting is a gift, even with its imperfections. But we have stability and blessings that many other countries and many other individuals do not have. We didn't all do this by ourselves, right? This is a gift, and that comes from God. And so that does create humility, and I think also generosity to others. Mm. So it's not only my not receiving things, it's I can give to others. So I think if it creates an attitude not only of generosity, but of gratitude, but of generosity, that's a really excellent thing.
We have just about a minute left. I'd be curious. I'm mindful that for many people, the holidays is actually a time of pain and troubling. Maybe they've lost somebody and they're thoughtful of that. Is there a way, even in the midst of the loss of life, that we can have alongside of it, not to supplant it, but alongside of it, some gratitude in the midst of loss?
Right. I would hope that would be one extra benefit, that by remembering the gifts of those that we have lost, that would be helpful, right? To recognize that these lives were gifts to us and that we can appreciate for what they offered. Going back to the first Thanksgiving, though, there was a lot of loss there. People had lost spouses. They had lost children, right? There was a 50% death rate from the people who stepped off the Mayflower. So that might be a way to connect back and to say they were giving thanks, even recognizing that it had not turned out the way they had expected. And they carried on, and they found chastened joy in the midst of that. And maybe that can be an encouragement to us who are having a hard time this holiday season.
Yeah, that's a great word. Boy, I learned a lot about Thanksgiving today, a lot more in this rich tradition as a country. Really appreciate you coming in and joining us on Faith Radio Mornings this morning.
Great. Delighted to share it.
Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll come back with more here next on Faith Radio Mornings. Sure appreciated that conversation with a historian like Professor Den Hartog, just bringing so much dimensionality to our Thanksgiving Day celebrations that we anticipate for next week. I know the Thanksgiving Day table will be a bit more meaningful for me when I think about some of the early experiences of the pilgrims coming to a table with people that they didn't know and didn't even know they could get along with, and yet they somehow found a way together. What a wonderful invitation. Well, I see up next hour, we're going to have some financial conversations with William Dickey. So get your questions ready and have the phone number at your fingertips at 877-933-2484 if you have some questions about finances as we head into the holiday season.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.